Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, politics, pro-life and the papal pilgrimage to Britain. As people in the United Kingdom vote in a general election, we hear from one of the country's best-known Catholic politicians and human rights campaigners. And the global phenomenon of migration. A meeting of experts from across the European continent asks how the Church can be more effective in supporting migrants' rights. Millions of people across the United Kingdom went to the polls on Thursday to elect members of Parliament for a new government, widely expected to usher in an era of change after 13 years of Labour Party rule. Over 44 million people were registered to vote, choosing between the main Labour, Conservative or Liberal Democrat parties, or the smaller Green, Independent or British Nationalist groups. Uppermost on people's minds is how the economy can recover from recession and how the next government can reduce a huge budget deficit and slow the spiralling national debt. But there are plenty of other challenges facing politicians who'll form part of the new government. Many of these were set out in a message ahead of the election by the Catholic bishops of England and Wales. Entitled Choosing the Common Good, it looks at some of the moral, ethical and environmental concerns that Catholics should consider as they go to the polls, not endorsing any particular party, but urging voters to choose those politicians who put the good of the nation before their own party or personal self-interest.
How we tackle issues like diversity, tolerance, pluralism, respect, I think they're the big issues that will face an incoming government.
Lord David Alton is one of Britain's best-known Catholic parliamentarians and human rights campaigners. Elected to the House of Commons in 1979, for the past 13 years he's been an independent member of the Upper House of Lords. This week he was here in Rome, so I seized the chance to chat with him about politics, his pro-life battles and the upcoming papal visit to Britain. Lord David Alton, welcome to Vatican Radio.
Thank you.
Tell us, first of all, if you can, just briefly, the reason for your visit to Rome.
Well, it was some young seminarians at the Venerabile at the English College here in Rome who, through their Wiseman Society, they have a series of talks at the college, and they'd asked me if I'd address the subject, the culture of death versus the culture of life. And it was an opportunity to speak to not just seminarians at the college, but people from the wider Catholic community in Rome as well. And it was a terrific meeting, and we had an excellent discussion afterwards, and inevitably looked at issues like the way that the biotech revolution has moved us on in Britain. It's led to things like the creation of animal-human hybrid embryos, to the destruction of 2 million human embryos since 1990. You know, on the abortion issue, it's led to laws that even allow a disabled baby to be aborted up to and even during birth. And I was very struck that even while I was here, the story appeared of a little baby aborted in Italy with a cleft palate that struggled for a day to try and recover, but no one treated the baby because, of course, the baby was being aborted. But for me, this is downright eugenics to abort a child for grounds of disability. And we talked about euthanasia and the laws that have led now in Holland to 3,000 euthanasias every year, 1,000 of which are involuntary without even the consent of the patient. And again, there was topicality because even on the day that I arrived, a story had appeared about the so-called Dignitas clinic in Switzerland and how they've just been literally disposing of the remains of the people to whom they give lethal injections and disposing of their remains in the neighbouring lake. Where's the dignity here? So we were talking about palliative care, about the hospice movement, about the positive alternatives to things like embryo experimentation, abortion and euthanasia. And then we went on to look at how the culture of death impacts on life in other ways, the sale of arms into Africa. 95% of the Kalashnikovs used in conflicts in places like the Congo or in Darfur, southern Sudan, Rwanda. 95% of the weapons come from outside Africa, made here in Europe in many cases, and the moral implications of that for people in countries like our own. So I found it a very stimulating evening, and since then I've been speaking to officials in the Holy See about the forthcoming visit to Britain by His Holiness Pope Benedict. And in addition to that, I've had a number of private meetings with people, talking to them about some of the issues that are facing Britain at the moment, not least in this general election week.
coming up just this week, as you rightly say. And of course, you were elected to the Houses of Commons in 1979, the youngest person, I believe, ever to win a seat in the House of Commons.
I wasn't quite the youngest ever, but I was the youngest in that Parliament. But more, I became the shortest lived as well, because the night before I was elected, the government collapsed and a general election was called. So on the Wednesday night, a general election was called. I was elected on the Thursday, took my seat a couple of days later and made my maiden speech within 2.5 hours and then had to fight another election 4 weeks later, but happily was returned and spent 18 years in the Commons till I stood down in 1997.
That was 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago. Now, what do you see perhaps as the biggest challenges facing the next government at this general election?
Well, I think the challenge facing politics, first of all, is the interesting one, which is that the difference I've observed is how instead of PC political courage, we've now got PC political correctness, and how parties that would have allowed conscience, for instance, to determine your views on the sorts of issues we've been discussing, abortion, euthanasia, embryo experimentation, the right of churches to run schools or adoption agencies or whatever it may be, that all these have now become subjected, at least in two of our parties in Britain, to party policy. And the dilemma that then causes Catholics about how they can reasonably engage in public and political life. So I think there is an issue there, one of religious liberty, that's going to have to be determined in the future. I think it would be a big issue. It also sits alongside how we deal with not Muslims, but radical Islamization, which is a different thing altogether, where people will use religious ideology or a political ideology and use it to promote violence and to try and impose it on people who would be unwilling to receive it. So how we tackle issues like diversity, tolerance, pluralism, respect, I think they're the big issues that will face an incoming government. But needless to say, I mean, the economic issues as well are pretty vital at the moment. Look what's happening in Greece, and like a game of grandmother's footsteps, that's likely to be enacted out across the Mediterranean, particularly in Spain and Portugal. And Britain is by no means immune. I mean, we carry at the moment the biggest ever national debt. We're indebted up to our eyes, and whichever party comes into power, they're going to have to make some extremely unpopular decisions.
The Catholic bishops in Britain, of course, have issued a document to voters looking at some of these important issues. Do you think there is such a thing as a Catholic vote in Britain today or not?
I think that there are issues that Catholic voters care about. People say to me, well, which of the parties would you vote for? And of course, I sit as an independent these days, so I don't have any party axe to grind. But I say to them, no party is ever going to be the communion of saints. And if you're looking for a party that will tell you, you know, Evangelium Vitae or Humanae Vitae or Deus Caritas Est or one of the encyclicals is in the subtext of our programme, then I'm afraid you'll look in vain. What you should be looking for, and the bishops of England and Wales in their Common Good documents have said this repeatedly, you should be looking at the party's manifestos to see how well they fit with the teachings of the church, and then looking at the individual candidates as well, because candidates and parties sometimes disagree, and how you use your cross, which after all is a symbol with great meaning for any Christian, how you use your cross should be after you've formed your conscience. So you shouldn't do it tribalistically. You should be evaluating the candidates, looking at the parties and their programs, looking at the different leaders, and then asking yourself, how do these things fit with Judeo-Christian beliefs, with Catholic social teaching?
You've always been a very energetic pro-life campaigner. You left the Liberal Democratic Party, didn't you, when they began supporting abortion as their party policy. And yet this seems to be an issue that none of the parties are willing to really engage with.
Well, that is true, that none of the parties are, as it were, pro-life. None of them would say that they will fundamentally change the abortion laws, and all three political leaders have supported abortion to a significant extent. And we have laws that allow abortion, as I've said, up until and even during birth in the case of a disabled child, and that can be for something from cleft palate or club foot through to Down syndrome. In addition, 600 unborn babies are aborted every day in the UK, 7 million in the last 40 years. There should at least be proper public debate about the ethics of doing this. We don't have that debate. It's suppressed. And indeed, two of the political parties have policy on the question. But at least one of the parties has said, and indeed David Cameron, its leader, has said, this should remain a matter of conscience. And I'm glad about that as far as that goes. So I think the other parties need to think in the same way and revert to having conscience positions on these questions. Otherwise, it will be increasingly difficult. Ruth Kelly, one of the leading Catholics in the Labour Party, a wonderful woman who's been an excellent cabinet minister, standing down at this general election. And I have no doubt that that is connected with the problems that she had with being told initially that she would have to vote with a party line on issues like the creation of animal-human hybrid embryos or the creation of so-called saviour siblings or taking away the right of a child to know their identity. With the full force of British law now, two people, two women, can put their names on a birth certificate and say they're the parents of a child. But this is a deceit, because whatever one thinks about same-sex relationships and so on, this isn't to do with that. This is about who a child is and the right to know from what rock they were cut. And people want to ask the question, don't they, in their lives, who am I? There'll always be this desire to know who you are, and you shouldn't build in to the official documents of a nation an untruth. Because if you think your country can't even tell you the truth about having a biological father, then everything else becomes a lie after that as well. So I do think we have to address these questions rather more fundamentally than we have.
The Catholic Church is quite vociferous about these issues, but do you think there should be closer cooperation across the Christian denominations or with other faith groups who are also concerned about these things?
Well, the current Archbishop of Canterbury, Rome Williams, has been magnificent on these questions. Rome Williams is strongly opposed to experiments on human embryos and cloning, to euthanasia. And indeed, in fairness, all 26 of the Anglican bishops who sit in the House of Lords indicated their opposition to legalising euthanasia and assisted dying. And we've also received wonderful support from the chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, who's in many ways one of the greatest of our spiritual religious leaders in Britain today. Read his books like The Home We Built Together or Radical Then, Radical Now. They set out, the kind of teaching that Britain needs to hear if it's going to reshape its identity in a way that is more tolerant and is more genuinely respectful of other people's traditions.
There is increasing debate around this euthanasia issue, isn't there? It's become a real keystone, a real emotional issue.
Yeah. In the past 5 years, there have been three separate votes in the House of Lords by people trying to legalise assisted dying and euthanasia, laws like those enacted in Holland, Belgium, recently in Luxembourg, state of Oregon. And so far, so good. Those have been defeated by quite significant margins. And I think occasionally we should ask ourselves the question, why was that? And for me, the reason can be summed up in those words of the encyclical Fides et Ratio, faith and reason. The two have stood together. The faith leaders have been united right across the board in saying that, you know, we should not do this. We shouldn't be killing the elderly. We should be resisting the arguments, those of people like Lady Warnock, who said recently in one of our national newspapers, I mean, she said that if you've got dementia, then you're becoming an imposition of burden, she said, on your family. And she said you are wasting the resources of a National Health Service. This is an appalling argument to put forward. And there needs to be a clear religious, ethical and philosophical argument that is put forward to counter that. And I'm glad to say that our religious leaders, but also other philosophers, have countered it. And then on the other end of the spectrum of faith and reason, the British Medical Association, almost all of the Royal Colleges of Physicians, Psychiatrists and so on, the palliative care movement, the disability rights movement, have all come together to oppose any change in the law. And there's one other thing, I think, which has helped us so far in this battle, and that is that thanks to that illustrious Englishwoman, Cecily Saunders, and indeed to the work of so many of the churches, including the Catholic Church in Britain, we have a wonderful hospice movement in Britain. You don't need a doctor to give you a lethal injection to die with dignity. You can have a good death surrounded by love and care. You don't need to be in suffering and in pain. And I think we have managed to get that message across. And as a consequence of that, so far we've resisted the desire to change the law. The alternative to that will be the kind of situation in Switzerland where people are given a lethal injection, or Holland where they moved from turning a blind eye to voluntary euthanasia and now involuntary euthanasia. 3,000 deaths of the terminally ill, the suffering, and indeed people who are just disturbed. 3,000 deaths a year now for euthanasia, 1,000 of which are involuntary, that is, without the consent of the patient. So I think we just have to keep reminding people of, if you authorise this, that is where it will end.
You're also well known on a broader level, if you like, as a spokesman for human rights in some of the most oppressive places around the world, lobbying the government on countries like Burma and North Korea, Sudan, the DRC and so on. How much do you think these issues resonate with people in Britain today?
Oh, they resonate. And, you know, Britain does still have a a great love of the underdog, and there's a sense of fair play and fairness in the country. And as Catholics, we would talk about Imago Dei, that every person is made in the image of God. And I would say, from the womb to the tomb, at every stage of their lives, you should speak out for human rights and for human dignity and the sanctity of human life itself. And when you go into countries like Burma, I've been in illegally a couple of times, North Korea, where I go again later this year, but I'm chairman of the parliamentary group on North Korea. I've been a couple of times there, or to the Congo, where 6 million people have died over the last 15 years. There's nowhere else in the face of the earth where there's been such an attrition rate, but it barely makes a headline anywhere in our national newspapers. Darfur, where I've been, 300,000 people have been killed, 2 million people have been displaced, 90% of the villages have been burnt to the ground. And earlier, 2 million were killed in southern Sudan during the civil war there. And we turn a blind eye to many of these events. They are pro-life questions as well. So we have to wake people up to the realities of it. It's easier, actually, on those issues, I find, than on the beginning of life questions.
And yet, as you say, it doesn't make it into the media. There isn't much public attention to it on the whole in the press.
But things do start to change. And for instance, in China, there is change in China. It's gradual, it's slow, you have to be methodical. And if you look back to what's happened in Europe over the last 30 years, you can have some sense of optimism. I first got involved in these issues when I was a boy at school and the tanks were trundling into Prague in the Soviet Union. They were being crushed by Moscow. Who would have believed then that we would live through all the events in 1989? I mean, I travelled in Eastern Europe a lot when I helped found the Jubilee campaign. I remember meeting a bishop in Ukraine, Pavlo Vasilik, who'd spent 17 years in prison, and Ivan Gel, chairman of the Committee for the Defence of the Catholic Church, there, 18 years in prison. A young priest who'd been sent to Chernobyl to clear radioactive waste as a punishment for being caught celebrating the liturgies in the open. Today, Ukraine has a democracy. They've just changed their leadership. It's not perfect, but where is? But it's very different. Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, all these countries which were part of a totalitarian system, when the wall came tumbling down and we saw phenomenal change. So, yes, I think we'll see change in North Korea. I think we're seeing change in China. I think we'll see change in Burma, but and in Africa as well. But we just have to persevere constantly, beavering away, doing small things. You know, you either end up despairing because you think you can't do anything about the scale of events, or you start planning such big things that they're completely impractical and impossible. But
you're a great believer in the power, consumer power, aren't you?
I am. I just think person to person, parish to parish, individual to individual, you know, community to community. You can do things. The rabbi who said the man who saves a single life saves the world, and he was right about that. I think you shouldn't despair that there are 800 million people racked by starvation or despair, living below any rational definition of human decency in the world, or looking at the statistics about the number of children who die every day. If you just looked at those things, then you would despair. But if you think, well, what can I do about it? John Henry Newman, who the Pope will beatify this year, said, if a man waited until he was perfect, until he did anything, then he would end up doing nothing. So I content myself that with my own imperfections and failings, there are little things that you can do that can make a difference.
My thanks there to David Alton, an independent member of the British House of Lords and well-known human rights campaigner. And if you enjoyed listening to him, well, watch this space over the coming weeks for more of that interview, looking in depth at the challenges Pope Benedict will be facing when he sets off on his pilgrimage to England and Scotland this September. Multicultural, pluralistic societies are an inescapable feature of Europe today. That was the premise of a meeting of bishops from around Europe gathered in Malaga, Spain this past week to discuss the problems and prospects related to the growing phenomenon of migration to and from the continent. The meeting of church leaders and other experts was organised by the Council of European Bishops' Conferences, looking at three areas where the Catholic Church focuses its advocacy and pastoral work to uphold the dignity and rights of migrants, that is, the family, the parish, and the wider society. Father Duarte da Cunha is Secretary General of the Council of European Bishops' Conferences. He told me more about the goals and the challenges of this meeting.
This was the 8th Congress on Migrations organized by the CCE, the Council of the Bishops' Conferences in Europe. And this time our commission decided to propose as a main theme the persons in movement in Europe. as a main theme. That means we would like to look for the persons, not only for the social problem that may be the migrations, but the migrants. But looking them through their dimensions of family, community, parish, and society. So the subtitle was Overcoming Fears and Perspective, Designed Perspectives. So we would like also to see that there are many problems, many fears migrants came with. Some of them are normal problems, normal fears. Other are circumstantial fears. The fact of the some of them are poor and are miserable or have many difficulties or came from countries without preparation. Others instead are just migrants moving for better life, some of them with a good standard of life. So all these people have different fears, but nevertheless, with the church, we hope to help them to overcome all these fears. And also to perspective the future. It's almost sure for everyone that this big, big, huge dimension of movements in persons will grow, or at least will stay like that. Many people will change from countries. These globalizations is very, very evident that will be happen. And so we have to be prepared for that. This comes with dialogue, with the necessity of keeping also the identity, the cultural identity each one has from his family, from his country, from his nation. And so it's a dialogue between the necessity to find the other one and at the same time to know myself. And this is the multiculturalism, or the intercultural dimension of our life. There are two extremes. No? One is thinking that we have to be assimilated. If we change countries, we have to be assimilated. The other one is we have to create a kind of ghetto. But we have to find somehow, because it's not fair, it's not just to have these extremes, but to have a possibility to keep our identity at the same time to be welcomed and live together with the others, with other cultures, because we have the same human nature. We have this. We are all created at the image of God.
You released a final message from this meeting. Who is it addressed to, and what do you hope to be able to achieve with this?
The final message is, in a certain sense, is telling everybody what we have done here. The message is directed to everyone who is, in a certain sense, concerned with migrations. But as we have heard here, I think everyone in Europe has something about migrants, or he is a migrant, or someone of his family is a migrant, or someone of his neighbor is a migrant, and so everyone more or less is concerned with this, and it's very important to be concerned with it, even if it's not the most urgent problem. It's not the unemployment, it's not a financial crisis, but it's very, very important, because it's spread by all Europe, no? So we think it's very important also to have a Christian and Catholic way of view this phenomenon, this movement of people, and to have an anthropological and personalist, humanist perspective, just to help also the political, the cultural people, everyone who can also help to create a better society. In the end, we speak for the migrants, mostly for those who are more suffered migrants, because there are those who are very poor, very, very lonely, very vulnerable. And to those, we want to say we are with you. As we have heard here, there are many things the church has been done to help the migrants. There are more things to do, of course. Things that can be taken from the point of view of the Caritas, of the helping, social helping, but also spiritual and community helping, and receive them to feel themselves at home, in a certain sense, with the church.
Father Duarte da Cunha, Secretary General of the Council of European Bishops' Conferences. Among the participants at the Malaga meeting was Bishop Patrick Lynch, auxiliary in the London Diocese of Southwark and head of the English Bishops' Office for Migration and Refugee Policy.
First of all, because all of the participants, many of them have been very actively working with migrants, people were very aware of the fears, both within migrants and migrant communities and in host communities that are present within all of Europe. So it was very much based in reality, not on any kind of superficial, very general observations. I think the second thing that one would say was that while people were aware of the fears, people also emphasised again and again and again the different ways, in practical ways, that the church can overcome those fears, can help people overcome those fears, but also be a sign and a source of hope in accompanying migrants, in giving space for migrants, not just physical space, but also that sort of emotional, spiritual space whereby people can celebrate their identity, but also find a way in a new society in which they find themselves. And last but not least, I think the conference was grappling with the issue of how can the church, as a church, sometimes it's a minority community, sometimes it's a very strong majority community, influence the public policies that governs in Europe especially are at the moment advocating and trying to put into practice.
There was a strong call from this meeting for trained, for skilled priests, deacons, lay pastoral workers who can really understand the very complex emotional as well as, of course, as you say, the economic, political, social, cultural issues concerned with this phenomenon of migration.
That indeed is a very difficult challenge, and it is a much needed role that the church can take on. In many of the churches, especially in the Mediterranean countries, the church uses and has for many years used that word accompaniment. Perhaps more than the northern European countries, but I think it's beginning to be used everywhere now. The church sees itself at the one level of accompanying communities, accompanying individuals and accompanying families. Now, to do that, you need to be able to enter into, first of all, the life, the family and the culture and the community that you're accompanying. Sometimes it might be knowing the language. Sometimes it's knowing the customs. Sometimes it's knowing and being sensitive to the suffering. But that's the first step of it. It's basically seeing the situation and being sensitive to it. And then the second step is kind of walking along with the people and hearing the story and sometimes pointing them in the direction where they can get more specialised help if that is needed, pointing the direction of where they can find a community where they can belong, pointing direction to where they might be able to develop their skills in education. I think a lot of that is being done, but it's in an informal way. The one example I could give of a church that does that in a very, very profound way, in a very methodical way, is the Filipino church. The Filipino church has 10 million migrants overseas, all over the developed world, in the east, in the Gulf area. And one of the things it does is have very, very good programs for the training of lay people who are the leaders and really the ministers for those migrant communities living the Filipino diaspora.
My thanks there to Bishop Patrick Lynch, Auxiliary in the London Diocese of Southwark and Head of the Office for Migration and Refugee Policy for the Bishops of England and Wales. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again tomorrow at this same time or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.